Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's First Principles Conference Call. At the suggestion of one of our long-term clients, we are changing the tone and direction of the call for at least tonight. Many of you recall, in our conference calls, we have focused the attention on variables that affect markets, and we have talked little about the investment process or particular stocks. Tonight, we will concentrate our call mostly on the securities that we choose and why we choose them, and a little of the factors that are affecting the market. Tonight, Robert, Stephen's First Principles Financial Analyst, will be interviewing Steve. We hope you will find the conversation most interesting.
Thank you, Nora, and thanks to everyone joining us. I'm not going to take up too much of your time here, so we can basically start off with one simple question. Steve, when you work with a client's portfolio, what is the most important factor that you look at?
Well, when I first started managing money in the 70s, it couldn't have been a worse time to start out. After my first year as a securities analyst, I asked myself, why didn't I go to medical school? The stock market peaked in 1969 and remained essentially flat until 1984. And you know, those investors who had an all-stock portfolio and held it from 1969 to 1984 actually lost money during that period. My grandfather left me $15,000 in a trust at the bank I worked at. That $15,000 became $10,000 by 1984. My professors at UCLA and my boss at Security Pacific, now the Bank of America, taught me some valuable lessons about investing. First, look at the risk you're taking and manage your portfolio for that risk.
Great, Steve. Let's focus on risk there. How do you manage for risk?
Well, whenever I look at a stock or bond for purchase, I carefully think about the downside risk. Without getting too technical about it, I like stocks that have low volatility and not flavor of the month.
What do you mean by, quote-unquote, flavor of the month?
Well, my boss at the time told me, and so did my reading with Benjamin Graham in The Intelligent Investor, that it's dangerous to follow crowds and buy stocks that everyone else does because you're going to end up getting trampled. This has to do with the flow of information more than anything else. So let's say, for example, you like Tesla. Wow, I wish I could have a Tesla, but I don't like the stock. How many analysts follow it? How many individual investors follow Tesla? Everybody knows about Tesla. However, how much more can you or I learn about it? For that matter, how much can the other guy learn or know about Tesla? I don't think very much. So therefore, Tesla is an efficient stock. It's hard to make a market-beating return buying efficiently priced stock.
But wait, but hasn't Tesla reached new highs and hasn't it surpassed Ford Motor Company in value?
Yeah, Tesla's gone up a lot, although the stock price has been essentially flat for 3 years except for the last 2 weeks. But that's my point. How can Tesla be worth more than Ford when Ford has six times the revenues? I'm not saying I want to buy Ford, but it has a broad lineup, makes 100 times the profit of Tesla. I mean, Tesla only makes money from credits that they sell from the subsidies they get from the U.S. government for having electric cars. So where do you think there's more risk? In my opinion, not Ford, especially when one considers that Tesla is so mired in debt. If you look at the debt structure of Tesla, Elon Musk owns most of the debt. So if he runs out of money trying to finance the company, that company could be in trouble. But these are things I think about and not necessarily the investors that think about that.
Fair enough. What factors do you look for in a stock?
Well, I look at what the potential downside risk could be. I'm careful to look at the debt and the company's strategy. If a company has too much debt, they may not be around if the earnings decline or they can't roll over their debt. And, of course, it doesn't end there because when we take a look at a stock or bond, there are probably, well, you should know this, 60 factors that we consider.
But why are you so cautious, Steve?
Well, the truth is I don't want to go to my clients and tell them that I lost 40% of their money and now they'll have to work at Burger King in their retirement.
Come on, Steve, honestly, could that really happen?
Well, of course it could happen. Donald Trump got elected. Anything could happen. However, experience has taught me to take prudent risk, and that involves looking at the risk of the stock and that of the portfolio.
So then this has basically happened in the past then, right?
Well, not with me, but certainly with other money managers. For example, if an investor was totally in the stock market in 1973-74 with a 100% stock portfolio, they might have lost 45% of their money. Hey, I know I was there. My boss lost 45% of his money. In 2000, one client told me he had lost 95% of his money because he was 100% invested in tech stocks. He used to drive a Mercedes. In 2001, he was driving an Oldsmobile. In 2008, the S&P was down 37%. We were down a lot less than that.
And this is basically why you preach having a balanced portfolio.
I talk about balanced portfolios all the time. That's what I just think about. I not only assess the risk of each security, but I assess the risk of the entire portfolio. This is why I have stocks, bonds, alternatives, and my portfolios are generally diversified. I've not wanted to be 100% in stocks since I started out as a greenhorn in 1973 or 74, and I'm glad I didn't have 100% stocks in year 2000, 2008, and 2011.
Now, you mentioned the year 2000 a couple of times now, so it must have been a pretty bad year.
Yes, Hal. You can turn the computer off now, Hal. Oh, that's right. You're not talking about 2000, A Space Odyssey. You're talking about the dot-com bust. Okay, yeah, well, it was for several reasons, which are some of our parallel today. The dot-com stocks were absurdly priced. For example, Qualcomm sold for 4,000 times earnings, and Cisco had a measure of book value to the price price-to-book of 144. That was insane. The market darlings at that time were Qualcomm, Cisco, and Ron WorldCom. If you take a look at chart one, it shows when Cisco Systems peaked in year 2000. And look at the waterfall downslide, and it's never even recovered. If you look at chart two, same thing with Qualcomm. The waterfall downslide occurred. Now, Qualcomm has recovered, but now it's below its peak in the year 2000. So if you were one of those investors who bought these kind of dot-com stocks at the peak and you were, you know, having a kind of pray and hold investment philosophy, you wouldn't be whole even today. Today, Cisco is much more reasonably priced than Qualcomm, WorldCom, Enron, and Tyco aren't even around. By the way, AOL is another loser. Those investors weren't investing. They were gambling. It's no different. For today, Tesla, which we mentioned before, Amazon really doesn't make any money either, yet people buy these types of stocks like they did in the dot-com bubble. People will relearn an expensive lesson once again. You can see that it never recovered from the fall in 2000. But if you don't think it can happen in stocks like Amazon, Tesla, Facebook, and Netflix, you would be wrong.
All right, Steve. So what stocks do you like then? I mean, if you don't like tech or if you don't like the flavor of the month stocks, as you say.
Well, Robert, we talk about this all the time. I didn't say I didn't like tech. I love tech, but at a reasonable price. And I'm not going to buy tech stocks that I feel I can get trampled on, even though the price could be going up. I like companies that do everyday stuff, and more importantly, if they still made that lard Crisco, I'd probably buy that company. They have a competitive advantage.
What else can you tell us about your investment style?
Well, I like individual stocks and bonds because over time I don't have to worry about getting trampled on if everyone heads to the exits. This doesn't mean I will totally escape or not lose money. For example, the folks in the S&P 500 index fund who invested in the top of the market in 1999 didn't get back even till 2012. I mean, take a look at chart three. It's clear as day, and the facts speak for themselves that in this chart, people who held on to that and did not have a balanced portfolio really got hurt over that period of time because they didn't make any money. What's interesting today is index investing is now flavor of the month, right? The Wall Street Journal had this big, you know, articles on index investing. But ironically today, it said that index investing is very bad for retirees. And so if you look at today's edition of the Wall Street Journal, it goes on into the facts, the various facts, which we don't have time here, but it basically said that index investing is very bad for retirees.
Okay, I think we understand now, but let's take a look at the other side of the coin. Could you please discuss some of your personal favorite stocks?
Okay. Well, that's a good idea. I think, you know, some folks hate utilities. I love utilities. Some people think they're plain boring. I think they're great. I have news for you. Utilities can be great performers over time and not too risky, at least in comparison with some other stocks that are more aggressive. Next Era Energy is one of these. It was like in the 70s. You know, the old Standard Oil Company of New Jersey had to come up with a sexy name because people didn't like the name Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. It became Exxon. NextEra Energy was the old Tampa Electric Power Company. It's just a utility. Now, I have to say it's a great company because it's the largest utility of solar and wind power. And the dividend has been increased regularly, and not to make a pun here, but the future is bright. If we take a look at chart four, you can see that the hockey stick of NextEra Energy is just as good as in chart five, which is Apple, right? So Apple went nowhere from 1995 when they went public to year 2005. The facts speak for themselves. Now, granted, when the iPhone came out in 2005, Apple has really done well, right? But they depend on one product. 60% of Apple's earnings come from the iPhone, and 23% of those earnings are from China, and China hates Apple. China wants to champion its three national champions, Xiaomi, Levano, and Huawei. So we have these kind of discussions here in the office all the time, but I like companies that have predictable earnings and that will do over time. Avista is another electric utility in Seattle. So, you know, investors get so excited about stocks like Apple, even if they go up a few points, but then they don't want to consider stocks like Next Energy or Avista.
All right, Steve, what else do you have? What other ones do you like?
I like Cisco. This is the other Cisco, the Cisco with an S. They deliver food to restaurants, camps, colleges, and the like. Very reliable and growing dividend. This is an example of a boring stock that has a strategic advantage that can do well over time. I would rather have non-sexy than sexy. Less risky to me, but hey, that's at least my opinion.
All right, Steve, I know you expressed your feeling about tech stocks, but there must be some that you like, right?
Yeah, well, the other thing I forgot to tell you about was railroads. I like railroads because they're a monopoly. To me, they're low risk over time. Think about it for a moment. Do you think anyone in the U.S. will build another transcontinental railroad? Not in your lifetime. However, railroads like CSX, and if you take a look at chart 6 and Norfolk Southern, chart 7, they have duopolies because railroads will never be built. Combine that with increasing dividends and you have a recipe for success. Now back to your question about tech stocks. Like I said before, I like tech stocks, but I don't want to overpay for them. Do you want me to buy tech stocks and take it out of your salary in case they bomb? Of course not. What if their market dries up or some unforeseen competition heats up? MySpace was the tech stock flavor of the month about 10, 15 years ago. News Corp bought it for $750 million and just sold it for $18. Technology changes frequently, and I like tech stock, but I want a defensive strategy. Take a look at Chart 8, Elbit Systems, which is a cybersecurity company. It has a very defensive posture, has a good space within the tech industry. Or take a look at CyberArk, which is another example of a high-tech, defensible cybersecurity fund.
Steve, you're a big fan of timber stocks, aren't you?
Yeah, well, you know me. I like timber, and we've owned them for a long time. Because why? They pay great dividends, perform well over time, and they can be an inflation hedged.
Could you explain to us what inflation hedge means?
Yeah, I mean, inflation hedge is different than an inflation hedge. Nothing in my opinion is inflation proof, including gold or silver. In fact, gold has had a terrible track record in inflationary times. We have bought gold but not for inflation. We use that as a portfolio protector, again, to watch our downside risk. However, for example, during the 1980s, when inflation was averaging 4 to 5%, which isn't all that much, the price of gold went nowhere.
Okay, well then what's your favorite timber stock?
My favorite timber stock used to be Plum Creek Timber, but it merged with Weyerhaeuser a few years ago. We still have Rayonier and Potlatch, but my favorite is Weyerhaeuser. If you take a look at Chart 9, it's the world's biggest tree farmer. They practice sustainable forestry, and they care about the environment. They don't have a scorch-the-earth mentality. Interesting enough, Weyerhaeuser is a low-volatile stock, except for the period when they converted from a paper and timber company to a timber company, and they have a very healthy and growing dividend.
Okay. Well, could you tell us something about Alexander & Baldwin?
Yeah, Alexander & Baldwin, we have had that as long as I can remember. I think I've owned it since I've been in diapers. The stock has not performed as well as I would have liked. But you know what? It has done reasonably well because of the dividend. These guys own a lot of property, including 100 industrial parks, 93,000 acres of land in Hawaii, and some of that land is right on the coast, and they're developing it, and it should do well over time. But so far, I'm still disappointed in it.
Well, what about Pepsi? It's kind of been in the news recently. You've owned Pepsi for a very long time as well, but isn't there a problem with soda and sugar?
Well, personally, I don't drink Pepsi. I drink Coca-Cola Zero. So I don't have to deal with the soda and the sugar, although my doctor is trying to get me to off this stuff and drink water, but, you know, that tastes like crap. So, you know, we have owned Pepsi. You know I go down to the cafe. What do I buy? A bag of what?
Chips?
Yeah, I buy a bag of Lay's. Frito-Lay potato chips. Sure, believe it or not, Pepsi is not all sodas. In fact, soda is becoming a small part of Pepsi. Frito-Lay is the biggest generator cash for them. They've also, unfortunately, diversified into healthier foods. I think Nora would like that. But Pepsi has really transformed itself.
All right, Steve, we both know you can't bat a thousand as much as you like to. So give me one of your, quote-unquote, your dog stocks.
Oh, boy, you would put me on a spot here, right in front of all my clients. I have to, like, do a mea culpa?
I have to.
Okay. All right. Well, you're always going to have some stocks that don't do well in the short term. But if an investor is patient enough and he's correct in his analysis, then the stock may turn around. Our biggest disappointment lately is Gilead Sciences. I think it's a great pharma company. They're a leader in HIV and Hep C. They have a huge market share for both diseases. But the stock is in the toilet. It should be, but it is. The market thinks that Gilead should have a deeper pipeline and that the company should acquire another drug firm. My opinion is that they will acquire someone or be acquired.
Well, what about Vodafone? That doesn't seem to be doing too well.
Well, actually, Vodafone is doing well. They have a stronghold in their major market, Europe, Africa, India, too. It's a great company. But the stock has done poorly lately because of Brexit fears that has affected the British pound. The British pound, if you recall, went from 151 to 123. And so we had currency risk.
Okay, Steve, I'm nearing here to the end of my question. So this will be my final question, at least. And we're going to go in a slightly different direction here. I heard that you're starting a sustainability fund. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I am so excited about this. You know, as many of you know, and here in the office, I'm very concerned about the environment and corporate governance. Building a sustainable responsible portfolio is easier said than done. You have another set of investment factors to consider in addition to the ones I mentioned. You know, it's very time-consuming and not easy to measure corporate governance and find companies that practice sustainability and are good environmental stewards. A lot of fact-checking and on-the-ground analysis needs to be accomplished before an investment company can truly say it's a sustainable investment. Some firms claim to have a sustainable, responsible portfolio, but to truly say it's a sustainable investment, some firms really are not. So what we have done is, in conjunction with Oxford University, my home away from home, SFP has been working on a sustainable, responsible fund that screens for corporate responsibility, the environmental, and most importantly, social impacts. We're excited about this portfolio, and now we're putting it on the final touches on this, and we will launch it in August at our event on August 9th.
5th.
August 5th.
Yes.
Yes, August 5th. I just reminded, August 5th. Mm-hmm. We have no comparable benchmarks which to judge the returns of this fund, so we don't know what the returns will be, at least not at this time, but I believe we're at the cutting edge of this type of investment, and one day it will become the norm. I'm very excited. Our conference is titled, The Future Is Now. The Future Is Now, and Be Prepared for It. And it's going to be August 5th at the Balboa Bay Club. We hope that everybody attends because it's going to be very exciting. We're going to be talking about artificial intelligence and how robots are going to start to replace people. We're going to be talking about healthcare issues like we did last year. And then most importantly, we'll be talking about why we think that social responsibility portfolios belong in everybody's investment arena.
Wow. Well, that's pretty exciting, Steve. Well, that'll basically do it for the questions, at least for me. As always, this has been a pretty informative conference call. If you guys have any feedback or any comments, we would love to hear them. I would also like to thank Steve, of course, and for all of you in participating in tonight's call. We will now open up the phones for any questions and comments you guys may have.
The conference has been unmuted.
The lines have been unmuted. Please feel free to ask your questions now.
Hey, Steve. Steve, this is Ron Ruby.
Hey, Ron, how are you?
I'm good. What's going on with YY&R? Is that going to stay open or are you going to close it?
Nope, we're going to stay open. It's having a tremendous year. We're really that thing is firing on all cylinders. So I'm back in thrall with it.
What about all the regulatory issues?
Well, we haven't had any regulatory issues with YY&R. We had regulatory issues with SFP Forestry Fund.
I thought the maintenance of the fund and all the hoops that you had to jump through were prohibiting its success more than the stock picking.
No, that was really just confined to SFP Forestry Fund. We still have to go through a surprise examination for YY&R. As long as it doesn't become too costly, we're okay with it. If the cost of the surprise exam that the SEC requires, in other words, if they require us to do a gap audit instead of a regular audit and it costs us $20,000 to do it, we're not going to do it. So they've relaxed some of the things that we have to, I guess, be a hoop jumper on. So I think we're just going to keep it open at this time.
Anonymous person on your call. Steve.
What?
What? This is an anonymous person on your call. Steve, what do you plan to do for the people who just want to make money and don't care about all this environmental stuff and all this political stuff and things?
The research that I did at Oxford the last year, because when we opened the SFP Forestry Fund, we were really excited about that, but the SEC wasn't. So we never got it launched. So I spent an exhaustive year searching about a sustainable portfolio, which won't be a fund. It'll be an individual account, just like the other managed accounts. And what I had found out is that, I'm not allowed to talk about performance, because the SEC doesn't like it. But there is a possibility that it could do very well. But I'm not allowed by SEC to talk about that kind of stuff. However, if people don't want a social responsibility fund, they don't have to. They can just stay with the regular accounts that they have. However, when we do pick stocks, we already have looked at corporate governance issue on every stock.
Right. I think corporate governance is very different than social engineering.
Well, sure it is, but there are a lot of people, including your wife, who might like a sustainable, social, responsible portfolio.
Well,
right?
Maybe, but I can tell you some 35 years ago, the Harvard Fund was managed by a group of people, including the treasurer, State Street Management. And when Harvard decided to only invest in things that they thought were socially responsible, they resigned because they felt that the people
Isn't that amazing? It looks
were entitled to try to make the most of it, not the least.
Well, the thing is, if a person wants a social and environmental responsible fund, then they might have to accept lower returns. But I'm not saying it's for everybody. I'm saying is the demand from my clients have been, let's put it this way, people have voiced to me a demand for it, and so we're going to have it because they want it.
I can understand. You have a lot of Democratic clients. Congratulations.
Okay, thanks. Next question. Thanks, all. Next question.
And I don't
hey,
have
Steve.
A question. Steve, this is Moshe. This is a discussion. Now, the topic that was just brought up, I think, is worthy of a few comments, and perhaps for 5-10 minutes I'll have something to say about it, which will make everybody happy, even those who don't agree. In other words, the key is, what do you do to serve your interests? And I would like to suggest there are many ways to ask a question if I understand where people come from. And I do understand where the people ask the questions come from. And I would like to suggest there are ways of thinking about things when you try to bring that future to the present, as the topic of the August meeting is going to be all about. I think there is something for everybody. No one has the final verdict on what the future holds in store. But some of us, or some people, will get a little closer to it. And that's all what you attempt to do, and you have done it so far very successfully.
Well, thank you, Moshe. Thank you so much.
Moshe, I understand what you said, but what's that got to do with being socially responsible in investing
that,
as opposed to
I want to leave you with
as possible?
Here is what I'm saying. I always want to leave everyone with a taste for more. So this will give you a good reason to want to show up for the August meeting.
There you go.
Thank you, Moshe.
Thank you, Moshe. You're our best.
Trust me, I have been thinking about it all as much as you do, maybe a little less. I'm a little younger, but that's about all.
Yeah.
But harder.
Thank you.
Steve,
you're
how
right.
do you assess?
You have a point. You have a point. Everybody has a point. You're right. I'm not arguing with you. I'm saying how can we best serve the interests of everyone, even if they don't agree.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Steve, how do you
Agreed.
Assess corporate governance?
What's that?
How do you assess corporate governance?
Well, we've developed a checklist of different factors. Like, for example, if a company like Snapchat just came out and none of the investors get voting rights, is that good corporate governance? No, so we wouldn't invest in a stock like that. So that would be a good example of it.
So you've always suggested that looking at the that the annual reports don't always tell the whole story. Tell me how you calculate intrinsic value versus book value.
Well, book value is just simply on the balance sheet, and it's basically the equity of the company divided for the shares. But intrinsic value is we have a formula for that that takes into in consideration the earnings, the P.E. ratio, the growth rate, and interest rates. And that's how we calculate intrinsic value, and we do it mathematically.
Right. I remember I took the course, but my question
right.
is I can never believe the annual report. How do you know those are true? And the more I get into learning about balance sheets and so on, the balance sheet from one company does not necessarily reflect what the definition is for another company. The terms all change.
Yeah, no, you're right. I agree with you. So the most important financial statement of the between the income statement, the balance sheet, and the cash flow is the cash flow statement, because cash flow can't lie. And so if it's generating a bunch of cash, then you can take a look at the cash flow statement and look at the balance sheet and see if it jives up. Like, for example, in year 2000, you know, my colleagues would say to me, oh, you know, Steve, you got to be in Enron or you're going to be behind the benchmark. So I took a look at Enron, you know, and the balance sheet was all fabricated. Everybody knows that by now. So I looked at the cash flow statement, and it just didn't line up. So I didn't know exactly what was wrong, but I knew something was wrong, so we passed on it. And so you have to look at the cash flow statement with really a magnifying glass, and that will tell you if the balance sheet is somewhat accurate or not.
Does that take into account with your formula, with your calculator?
Yeah, it does. So, okay. But when we have lunch, I think Liz is scheduling all that. I can just go and show you how it's done. It's not that complicated.
Steve, I have a question. Why doesn't everybody have AT&T in their portfolio?
Well, we don't have it.
Why not?
Because I don't like it.
It pays a good dividend. It's a very strong company, and it just got a $6.5 billion job from the government. What's wrong with a company like that?
Well, they keep doing stupid things, and I don't care for them. I mean, you know, first they bought telecommunications from a brilliant guy named John Malone, who suckered them into that deal, and then they got rid of it, and now they're buying DirecTV. I mean, they just keep making the same stupid mistakes all over again.
Well, as we both know, when you're that big, you can afford to make a little thing here and a little thing there. It's a nick. This company is going to be here for a long time. It pays a good dividend. It makes a lot of money. Seems to me that would be a prime target to be in everybody's basic portfolio.
Well, I mean, I appreciate your opinion, Saul, but not my portfolio, and I don't like it, you know? I mean, I can't buy every stock, I in the world, so I have to be selective. Any other questions?
Oh.
Hi, Steve. It's Kevin and Rochelle.
Hey, how are you?
We're good. Hey, what's up with the interest rates? They keep looking like they're going to go up, but then they never do. You think they're going to actually climb this time?
Yep.
Well, I guess the Fed interest rates are going up, the official rates, but there's something screwy going on there, Kevin, and that is the 10-year bond. It gets notched up a little, and then it keeps drifting down. Which, when you have that kind of discrepancy, where you know they raise interest rates, but the long bond starts to drift down. It's signaling something, and we're watching it, but we're not sure. So I don't know. I guess if they notch them up in January or June, we'll have to see if it sticks or not. It's just very peculiar to me.
Yeah, I've been noticing the same thing. So when you're buying bonds, are you still looking at mostly short-term bonds?
Well, yeah. I mean, we can have that conversation tomorrow, but I'll give you a call. But the reason why we haven't been acting on bond portfolios is the stock market is less risky than the bond portfolio, the bond portion, right? And I don't want to lock in, you know, in long-term bonds when I know interest rates are going to go up. I mean, today it said that the Fed will raise interest rates 2 times this year, 3 times next year, and then 3 times in 2019. And if that's true, I don't know if it's true or not. That will spell recession, and that will decimate bonds. So I'm very cautious on the bond side right now.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, but I'll give you a buzz tomorrow.
Hey, cool. Thanks.
Okay,
Dave. Russ Goodman. What are your feelings about China right now? What's going on? We have these conferences coming up with the premier. Are they stabilizing them and controlling their outflow?
Lure me in.
Well, I think what China was, Trump's rhetoric towards China has been pretty strong, but we'll know more tomorrow when he meets the president of China how tough he'll be on that. I mean, here's the two concerns I have about China. One is their debt is so high, it's like prior to 2008 here in the United States. I mean, they have a debt bubble that could just burst and blow up. And then, of course, that would affect us. A lot of people don't talk about it, but BCA talks about it, you know, all the time, and it's really problematic. That's one thing. The other thing is if we have a trade war with China, that'll be pretty nasty too. So those are the two things I'm kind of concentrating on, and I don't know if the president will keep his promise and say, you know, we got to reduce the deficit between China and the United States or not, but I guess we might have a bit more impression tomorrow. But regardless of that, China is just, I think, ready to implode with debt. So I'm getting a little nervous about that.
Thanks.
Okay, any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. If you have any questions and you were too shy to speak up, just call me or email me. We're always here for you guys, and we appreciate your confidence. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.